Be seated. Good morning, and welcome to the 10:30 docket, the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel is still to my right, Justice Ann Gardner, and to my left, Justice Sue Walker, and I'm still Leanne Dauphineau. All right, we have two cases set on this docket, both criminal cases out of Denton. Appreciate y'all coming here in this rain. I know it wasn't easy. Both sides ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Then, Megan, you want to call the case, please?
Court, counsel.
The peace matter is a single issue with regards to ineffective assistance. The record's fairly short. It's fairly clear what happened. Mr. Hughes, Carlton Hughes, was appointed to represent my client initially. Mr. Hughes clearly admitted to having numerous health issues. Those health issues impaired him to the point that he apparently neglected Ms. Peace and any offers that were out there and actually took the position that he thought he could do better than a 10-year deferred offer.
But he did convey the offer to her.
That's not clear from the record.
And who are you claiming was ineffective, number one or number two?
Actually, at this point, Carlton Hughes and Mr. McCarty. And
both of them?
Yes, ma'am. And the reasons initially with regards to Mr. Hughes, primarily it's because of the lack of conveyance and his illness. I mean, he pretty much admitted that he wasn't in his right mind. And I think it's clear if you've practiced criminal law at all, and apparently Mr. Hughes has, because there's a qualification procedure to be on the court-appointed list. There are a certain number of trials you're supposed to have, a certain number of... Yeah, you just got to have some history. My client was not probation eligible.
Well, she was deferred eligible, wasn't she? Wasn't she deferred eligible?
No. She had a prior felony out of another court.
So she was deferred eligible.
If the court agreed to it, yes. Which once they, you know, that's the problem. I'm not sure Judge Shipman would have. But that offer was not conveyed to her in the likes of you have a prior felony. This court typically doesn't give these. Apparently, prosecution probably missed it. The point is that that offer should have been conveyed, and the issue of her lack of eligibility should have weighed heavily. And I think that, and I will agree with the state, the ineffective assistance issue is typically a writ issue. I acknowledge that. And Rayburn is a writ case, but Rayburn clearly sets forth that you look at the entire set of circumstances and convey those offers and give your client the best advice you can.
But we don't know for sure whether the offer was conveyed, right?
My understanding is the offer was conveyed, but it was conveyed in a manner by Mr. Hughes. I never accept the first offer. I want to get a better deal. That's what the record reflects.
What about the second prong of Strickland?
I'm sorry?
What about the second prong of Strickland? Don't you have to show that the plea offer would have been accepted?
Yes. And the problem is, I think it's obvious from the record that we have that plea offer would have been accepted. That's the only reason I'm here. The issue, by the time she got to her third attorney, which is the one that actually created that record, I'm not quite sure exactly at that point what his thoughts were. Thought about this morning. The issue with regards to putting her on the stand and having her say that with a pending matter out of Kaufman County probably prohibited him from doing so. If the record reflects, I think she picked up another charge up in April. When this was actually proved up, Mr. Hardin was actually had his hands tied by everybody before him, both Mr. Hughes and Mr. McCarty. At that point, the offer was 20 years, no negotiation, no nothing. I think that at the point in time they actually went through this, it was a matter of throwing yourself on the mercy of the court, what little mercy was left at that point. And what we were doing at that point, or what he was doing at that point, was please don't hurt her too much. When the problem is when your client has a pending charge out of another county, putting her on the stand subjects her to a Fifth Amendment issue that I'm not sure he wanted to do.
Right, and I totally understand that, but that's trial strategy. I think to get over the second prong of Strickland, it still has to be in the record that she would have accepted the plea offer.
I don't necessarily disagree.
Tell me how you can get around that.
Well, my thought is at this point that given that she was not necessarily eligible for this, I think it's obvious that the plea deal would have been accepted.
Sometimes it's just a slow plea. I mean.
Oh, I agree. I agree. But I don't think that's what this was.
When she facing life?
At 5 to 99, yes. Yes. And I don't think this was an issue of a slow plea. I do agree. Those do occur. I don't think this was it. I think that the problem is Mr. Hughes was in a state that if, you know, if you were apt for a delay, any delay he got for her was attributed to his illness, not necessarily because he was trying to push this off to another day to try to get some sort of better deal. I think at this point he thought, and the record's clear, he didn't really even convey that offer to her the way he should have, I don't think. I mean, at the point in time, if you look at Rayburn, they've got to look at the entire set of circumstances. And her circumstances were obviously not good. He did not advise her, and the record has nothing in it that he advised her that your circumstances are such you probably ought to take this deal and run, which, I mean, I personally would have done, but that's neither here nor there. That's not in the record, what I would do.
She's never going to live out of probation.
She was already
picking up new cases while she was out on bond on this one, maybe. I mean, don't we need more of a record to determine whether, it, you know?
I would think the
problem is I'm having difficulty understanding exactly what her situation was with respect to the judge accepting or giving her deferred adjudication.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question. Are you saying whether the judge would or would not have?
I'm not understanding what the situation was. Apparently it was doubtful, but he might have.
I think that the judge probably would have if they would have accepted it just to clear his docket. The issue is, and the record doesn't really have it here, but the judge typically leaves that up. They have a long set from the first initial appearance to 90 days later, and then they run this, if you don't take the deal, then off you go. We're going to offer's off the table, and it's trial. They had a window of opportunity, and the record reflects that Mr. McCarty was hired 2 days before that window of opportunity was closed. The reason is because that's the way that court operates, that the judge probably would have accepted it had it been done by the 90-day deadline or the 2 days, within that 2-day span Mr. McCarty had. I think that the court would have taken that offer. I mean, it would have actually taken the plea, and it would have been resolved on a deferred basis.
And what's the evidence that he knew about that offer and the deadline?
Mr. McCarty, the evidence is that he did not, and it was in the file. It's States Exhibit 1, I believe, in the record. It was actually completed. And it's clear it's in writing, and actually Mr. McCarty actually came in and testified. The deal was off the table once he came in.
Right.
So, and it was the day, that was the day of the deadline. There might be an argument out there that he could have said, look, today's the day. I want to take it no matter what. And could have pushed the envelope, but that's not in the record either. I don't know. He was there on that day, and that one document says today's the deadline. I think it would be kind of a envelope pushing measure.
There's an argument that it'd be malpractice to put somebody with her record on a deferred. I mean, it's just a slow life plea.
Potentially, but it keeps her out of jail with a child. She's got a 13-year-old child, and that was part of what the state was arguing in their closing in this matter was that the reason she didn't take the initial deal is because it required 90 days as a condition, and she didn't want to go to jail because of her child. And she did have care of a teenager and in the house. So the problem is she was never given that choice, and I think you're right. I think that there may be an issue with regards to whether she could successfully complete it if she is picking up new charges, but that's her choice. That's her choice. She needs to have all of this explained to her the right way and say, look, these are all the options. These are how it works, and none of that's there. What she got instead from Hughes was, I'm going to get you a better deal.
I'm going to come back to this one more time, but There's a recent case out of our court, which Mr. Orbison is all too familiar with, called Aldrich v. State. And in that case, an en banc panel of this court held that, be that as it may, everything that you say is true, and say we found that both attorneys were ineffective in failing to adequately convey the plea, nonetheless, to get over the second prong of Strickland, which we don't even have to reach the first prong if we find that the second prong isn't satisfied, because the Court of Criminal Appeals has told us we can go backwards. We can do the first prong first. So to get over the first prong, you have to have evidence in the record that the plea would have been accepted. And so that's where I'm getting hung up with your argument.
Accepted by the court or accepted by the client?
Accepted by the client.
I don't disagree. And I agree with you. That is a big hurdle here because of the state of the record.
Mm-hmm.
State of the record indicates essentially all the conduct of the attorneys. And I think that Mr. Hardin, for whatever reason, and I'm having to guess to a certain degree, and I guess that puts us all in the position of having to guess, is that what he did was elect not to put her up because of that pending charge. And I don't necessarily disagree. I know that prong's out there, but the problem is when you have all those pending charges, how do you accomplish doing what he could for his client at that point? And I think that's the best he could do at that point. Now, I think that in the record, I believe it's on page 53, McCarty said, I would have told her to take it. I mean, and I think at that point, most of the clients come to you, I don't know, you're the attorney, that's what I'm paying you for. That kind of deal. And I would assume that she would have taken that. But again, the record doesn't necessarily have it. And I believe I do have an issue with the Strickland prong. I don't.
But there was some evidence that she wouldn't have taken it because of the 90 days.
I think the issue is that once it's explained to her, look, here's the problem. You might have to go to jail 90 days. But in the end, then you're on probation for this, or you're on deferred for this amount of time. But, you know, but get someone to take care of your child for the short
life.
Term. Right, right. And she might have made that choice. I can find someone for 90 days. I can't find someone for 24 years. That's an issue. I don't know I don't know where the child is right now. And I have a hard time keeping up with her because they keep moving her all over the state. So at this point, I don't know that she would not have taken that plea just because of the practicality.
The lawyer could have had her accept the plea in writing after the deadline. That way she wouldn't have had to testify. There would have been evidence in the record that she would have accepted the plea. So that's a possibility.
It is a possibility.
I think a record at least.
Yes, yes. I mean, the problem I have is that I don't know that Mr. Hardin, I think it's clear from the record, the way he was actually presenting the evidence was this was nothing more than an open plea at this point. At this point, it wasn't even a real, I don't know, the punishment hearing was more about whether the attorneys had done their job or right than it was, you know, what she had done, what she hadn't done. Here's what her past history indicates. That's really not in the record. It's not from the state even. It's more along the lines of this is what the attorneys did in representing her and why we need to have some mercy here, because it can't – obviously, Mr. Hardin couldn't complete a plea deal without the state agreeing. So he was stuck with, I got 20 years. What am I going to do? I can't do anything other than I think ultimately what he did was throw it at the wall and see what stuck. And unfortunately, it's 24 years worth of sticking at this point. So it's my position that I think you can, and we're put in the position of having to infer from the record. I'm sorry, for the Strickland prong. I don't have anything in writing. I don't have the issue of client on the stand admitting a subsequent offense and saying, I want this deal too, by the way. So I don't have that, and I'm sorry. But I think that it is fairly clear that there's a huge difference between being subject to 599 and the 10-year deferred deal. Thank you.
May it please the court. The problem with the case is that we're just all speculating about everything, really, because the record really doesn't show anything. It doesn't show, first of all, whether the trial court took into consideration at all the fact that her first attorney got up on the stand and said, I think I gave bad advice when I said, I think I can do better than 10 years. Doesn't show whether he considered that or didn't consider it. Her third attorney asked the judge to consider it in equity, to take an equitable position and consider it because it just wasn't fair. But the record does not have any indication. We're speculating about whether she would have taken it or not have taken it had the attorney explained it differently. I do want to take a couple of minutes and just I agree with opposing counsel's second statement about the record and whether she was ever conveyed the deferred offer, but not his first one. He first said the record doesn't show that. It does show that. On page 46 of volume 3 of the record, Mr. Hughes, did you communicate the offer to your client? Yes, sir. Did she wish to accept it at that time? No, sir. Thank you. No further questions. So it was conveyed, and that's fairly clear in the record. I do agree with what he said the second time. The attorney did testify that when he conveyed it, he also said, you know, I think I can get a better deal for you. But you know what? He also testified that's what he always says to every client. He always tries to wait after the state's first offer before he agrees to a deal or advises his client to agree to a deal. He always tries to wait to see if the offer can improve a little bit as time goes by. And so he actually testified reluctantly, admittedly, in the record that his practice in this case did not present any lower standard of care that he applies to any client in any situation. You know, there's also some ambiguity, although I think I've got it figured out. I think the offer was conveyed back in November of 2007 at a time when the attorney knew he had one blockage. It was kind of a minor deal at that point, the attorney's medical situation. But then the offer was conveyed. He said, let's wait for a better deal. And then 3 weeks later, he found out he had some serious medical trouble. That was in December. He had surgery in December, and then he was back at the courthouse in January 14th of 2008. Now, the offer was live until February 11th. He testified that in January, he was on drugs, and it was causing him to be out of his mind. It's a beta blocker that you take frequently after heart surgery. But he said that was only a problem in January. So after he got his drugs adjusted, he still had 11 days to convey the offer, and the record simply doesn't show whether he does or he doesn't. I will disagree with the opposing counsel that he said Attorney 2 did not know about the offer. That's not what the record says. Attorney 2 says, I don't recall. He was the attorney 2 days before the offer expired. He testified that he became the attorney because to try and get a better deal for the client. That's why he was hired. And yet he doesn't recall what the deal was. He doesn't recall if he knew what the deal was. I doubt if the trial court considered that particular testimony really credible. But he was an attorney 2 days before. But without belaboring all the points, the record just doesn't support ineffective here. That's what the trial court said, expressed during, as the defense attorney was arguing his case. He said over and over, you just haven't proven ineffective assistance here. We don't have that. And that's what the state is claiming at this point. If there are any questions, I wanted to answer Justice Gardner's question. What we had here is a case where a jury could not give community supervision, but a judge could. That's what we had. So that's why she had to go to a judge with this equity claim, hopefully that the judge would listen to this allegedly bad advice she received and would give her deferred. But that was the situation with deferred. If there are no questions, the state would simply pray that this court affirm the conviction.
Thank you. In rebuttal?
Just briefly, he was in the state's brief, and you just mentioned it again as to whether the trial court gave any consideration to any of this. It's kind of interesting because I don't think the judge can be a fact witness. So I don't know exactly how an appellant could actually get that information without putting the judge on the stand, unless the judge made findings of fact or, as Judge Wendell normally does, speaks his mind clearly to everybody in the courtroom. Without that, I don't know how you'd ever get that information as to whether he took any of this into consideration. He may very well have. We don't know, primarily because the judge is not a witness here. I think, and I do agree, the record does say that I believe Carlton Hughes does the same thing with all his clients. I don't take the first deal. This is how it works. But the problem is that's not how the law works. You take each client on their own. You don't treat them all. This isn't McDonald's, you know, and it's not Burger King. You know, you can't have it your way. We're not looking at I do everything the same with everybody. Every case is different. Every one of these is different. You have to take priors into consideration. You have to take, you know, what are the current situation. What do we have? And then, of course, then Mr. Hardin got it, and he had to take it in consideration also with the subsequent charge. So we all, as lawyers, have to take each matter on its own. You can't just say, I'm going to do this with every client. I don't know about the hiring to get a better deal. I think that was on cross. If you look in the record, that was what Mr. Jackson asked, if I remember correctly, of Mr. McCarty. And typically, yes, people do hire attorneys thinking, I'm going to try to get a better deal with this attorney or that attorney. But that is not necessarily proof that that's why my client did it here. I don't know that she was necessarily looking for a better deal. I think she just wanted some good advice. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We appreciate your argument. Your case is submitted. And I guess we're going to swap out the state.